The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are going to share probably in the neighborhood of 50 different pieces of information that you are not aware of. I'm a big believer in empowering people by giving them tools for positive change. Today, for example, new information on one good reason why you shouldn't be taking those antidepressants without looking for alternatives, and how you can help fight cancer if you have it by socializing with neighbors. Also, a plant extract that is very good if you have any form of bowel disease, and more on resveratrol for colitis. Then, commentary, Obama's health care bill is enough to make you sick, from TruthDig, Chris Hedges. My guest is going to be John Taylor Gatto, and the collapse of American education and America's weapons of mass education. Why our students today are dumber than a brick? Well, then again, we have teachers dumber than a brick. How did we get here? How do we get to a state of illiteracy? Well, I'll be introducing my guest, who is Teacher of the Year 3 times in New York State, with a commentary on the disappearing intellectual in the age of economic Darwinism by Henry Giroux. And I'm going to have Henry Giroux and Chris Hedges both on as guests on an upcoming program on the same show. That'll be interesting. And then an upcoming guest. Here are some of the topics we're going to deal with, because these are indeed truly topics for progressive-minded people. This afternoon, on my 3 o'clock show, Jeremy Scahill, investigative reporter for The Nation, and we're going to take a look at why can't we just take a chopping block and put the defense budget on it and just cleave off all that we don't need to keep our nation safe. How much would we be left with? How much is spent that is just insider dealing? We're going to deal with that. Then, tomorrow, I have Jeffrey Smith, one of the world's foremost experts on health and environmental risk of genetically modified organisms. So we will show you why we're opposed to Monsanto and DuPont and BASF's genetically engineered foods. Then, Lawrence Joseph is going to talk with us about all the misinformation and myths around the cataclysmic projections of 2012. Why it's all nonsense. Then, a conversation I'm really looking forward to, Elizabeth Satoris. Now, the last time I interviewed Professor Satoris was 3 years ago while I was filming Death by Medicine in California. She was at the Pacifica Foundation. Now, that has nothing to do with Pacifica Radio. This is a group of really brilliant intellects and humanists and behavioralists and psychologists in Northern California. And it overlooked the ocean. It was a very idyllic environment. And what I thought would be a half-hour interview turned out to be 3.5 hours of nonstop filming. And there was that very specific moment when I realized that what I didn't have in my film, an anchor of wisdom, let's say what Joseph Campbell was to Bill Moyer's mythology series, she became to my Death by Medicine series. In fact, I just came out of our editing upstairs here in our office in New York, and my editors and producer who are working on this said, Gary, you've got to do a very long director's cut of this film because there's so much positive information. I said, yes, do the long version first and edit down to a theatrical 1.5 hour version. And she is at the center of it. So you're going to have a chance to hear this woman. I'm sure you haven't heard her. You never see her on television. She's retired. She was a professor at MIT and University of Massachusetts. And she's an evolutionary biologist. She's a futurist and a professor of design of living systems. Then we have Paul Kingsnorth, one of the more creative-thinking British environmental activists, and he served as editor of The Ecologist. And we're going to talk about Western civilization is no longer sustainable. So when you look at your suburbs and your skyscrapers and your new development in, let's say, Detroit on the river, or in Baltimore, or in Austin, and you say, gee whiz, surely this is sustainable. No, it's not. So what do we do if our society and lifestyle is not sustainable? Well, we pay attention to people who can help us understand humanity's role in the web of life that's leading us to some drastic demises and be ahead of the curve. That's a conversation you have never heard on any radio station or television. It's an exclusive on the Progressive Radio Network. And then rounding out the week is Dr. Gwen Dyer, and she is a British-Canadian journalist, and she specializes in the geopolitics of climate change. And we're going to have a real look at all the actual science, the hard science of global warming. And then we're going to look at the pseudoscience of the denial of global warming. And we're going to use specific instances from television shows and radio shows of people say, well, global warming's a hoax or it's not man-made. And then we're going to show you how that got on there, which think tanks that are pro-industry created that information and then had talking points that were delivered by a scientist for hire that the host or producer of the show did not do their homework and, in effect, was used just as a propaganda tool. So that gives you an idea of the guests coming up this week, the topics and themes. Let's go to the latest on health and healing. What's in the water is in our bodies. What's in the water is in the body of fish and crustaceans, shrimp, oysters, lobsters, crabs. Then it's in our body. The more of this you eat, the more concentrated the pollutants are. Some pollutants are not easy to pass out of the system. Once they get into your system, especially once they get into your fat tissue, they stay there for long periods of time, like mercury or lead. They get into your bone. They can pass the blood-brain barrier and cause neurological damage. Now, we've known for some time that medicines, chemotherapy agents, tranquilizers, AZT, they go into the water through our urine and feces. And now they've been picked up in numerous water samples at small doses that are still biologically active. Here's the latest one. Antidepressants in water are making shrimp suicidal. Listen to this. I'll quote this. As reported from Aquatic Toxicology, a peer-reviewed journal, improving human mental health is having some serious unintended consequences for our friends in the ocean. Exposure to antidepressants makes shrimp 500% more likely to place themselves in life-threatening situations. And of the broader effects could damage the entire ecosystem. Exposure to the antidepressant fluoxetine, or Prozac, causes shrimp to radically alter their behavior. And while normal shrimp are more likely to avoid swimming towards light because it is often associated with prey, like birds, those exposed to the Prozac become 500% more likely to swim towards the light instead of away from it. That change in behavior places them in harm's way, and if enough shrimp are exposed to the antidepressant, the entire population could be at risk. Alex Ford, a marine biologist at the University of Portsmouth in the United Kingdom, explains how that can reverberate throughout the ocean ecosystem and why this is a serious problem. Quote, crustaceans are crucial to the food chain, and if shrimp's natural behavior is being changed because of antidepressant levels in the sea, this could seriously upset the natural balance of the ecosystem. Much of what humans consume can be detected in the water in some concentration. Where a nation's coffee drinkers, and there's high amounts of caffeine found in wastewater. For example, it's no surprise that what we get from the pharmacy will also be contaminating our country's water supplies. Well, one more reason to become a vegan. socializing helps fight cancer. A new study has suggested that living in an environment rich with physical, mental, and social stimulation, a setting that causes positive, mild stress, might actually curb cancer growth. This is a study from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, and they found that when you enrich an environment, it activates a nervous system pathway by which the brain talks to fat tissue. That pathway, called the hypothalamic adipocyte axis, tells fat cells to stop releasing a hormone called leptin into the bloodstream. Leptin normally helps restrain appetite, but this study discovered that it also accelerates cancer growth. Quote, people tend to think the cancer survivor should avoid stress, but our data suggests this is not completely true. You should have positive stress. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell. So what does this mean in lay language? Well, let's go back to 1978. The Institute of Applied Biology. I was a research scientist there at that time, and I was working up on the third floor, and I was apart from the other scientists because they were all doing hardcore chemotherapy work. They were all orthodox to the hilt. I was not. But I was getting results none of them had. In fact, it was very contentious at times, especially after one particular situation where I took the mice that were marked on their sheets on the outside of their little cage to be killed because the experiment wasn't working on radiation burns. And I took them upstairs because, after all, they were going to die. And then I used different ointments and nutrients and oxygen therapies and got them back to health. Then I was able to use them in experiments. Now, they denied this, the chief researcher downstairs, because he said, where'd you get your mice? And I said, I took the ones that were going to be killed downstairs. He said, well, that's not possible. He said, there's no, there's no way that you could have caused those mice to survive. I said, well, I did. And I said, come up and take a look. And there was this big argument. And where he was, you could see the veins in his neck expanding. I'm just sitting there listening to him. So finally, the director of the institute said, simple, let's go upstairs and take a look. So we went upstairs, and sure enough, every single mouse had a scar exactly in the middle of their back where the radiation burn was. And the director of the institute turned around to this man and said his name and said, you are an arrogant such and such. Don't you ever insult basic science. What Gary Null did is something that everyone in this institute should pay attention to. He did what none of the 19 scientists here could do, and instead of trying to learn from him, you try to mock and ridicule him, you open your mouth again in this institute, and I'm going to throw your ass out. That's what the guy said. So then, it didn't mean that my work was any better appreciated, because after all, you're dealing with human nature and envy and jealousy. But then I didn't have to take their mice. They actually gave me mice. And one of the very first six studies I did is I took mice that had been in downstairs, 500 of them, and they live in these little tiny boxes. It looks like a hat box with wire on the top, where they put the little rat pellets they reach up and get, and then a little water bottle. And I had the entire floor, a whole top floor, and I just let them run wild. And I would put their food in different places, and it was fun. And these rats were given a very interesting environment. I would put different music on different days to see which music they seemed to enjoy, which music chilled them out, which music agitated them, just so I could learn. And they really enjoyed soft music. So I put on some Stephen Halpern music and harp and flute. It was a very mellow place. And I remember once my brother Howard came in the city, and he came up there. And he comes up the stairs, and I worked at night, and it was late. And he said, he knocked on the door, and it was, I don't know, maybe midnight. And I opened the door. And he comes in, and he sits down, And it was like on the movie Willard. Suddenly there were like 500 rats all over him. He freaked out. Said, "What the hell's going on?" Started running for the door. I said, "Howard, they're not going to bite you." He says, "I'm not being around rats." He said, "God, Gary," he says, "you were strange back in West Virginia. You've gone super strange." So there I am. Rats all over me. Well, it was nice. I didn't have to worry about anybody bothering me after that. Nobody came in. I never got bitten. And had my favorite rats. I loved to be, patted and tickled. And very smart. But the more creative the environment, the more challenging the environment, the more they responded to it. Human beings are no different. Give people a boring environment, and you've got boring people. Next up, and by the way, those rats live 25% longer upstairs than ones downstairs. The diet was the same. Water same, light the same. The difference was restricted environment and depression, unlimited environment with challenges, and fun and creative environment, living longer. No different for humans. And two more articles, honey as an antibiotic. Scientists identify a secret ingredient in honey that kills bacteria. Well, we've known that it kills bacteria from ancient times. It is probably the most commonly used natural medicine in history. You can go back and see where in the Civil War, especially from the South, they would pack wounds that would otherwise become infected and gangrene with bee propolis and honey. And that helped kill much of those infections. Here's the latest in the peer-reviewed journal, FASBE Journal, and published in Science Daily. Quote, "Sweet news for those looking for a new antibiotic. A new research published in the current issue of the journal explains that for the first time how honey kills bacteria. Specifically, the research shows that bees make a protein that they add to the honey called defensin 1. Which could one day be used to treat burns and skin infections and to develop new drugs that could combat antibiotic-resistant infections. Quote, "We have completely elucidated the molecular basis for the antibacterial activity of a single medical-grade honey and which contributes to the applicability of honey in medicine," unquote. You bet it does, but don't go make a medicine you can patent. Just use honey. How many times have you heard me say that in the wintertime, start your day with some green tea and some bee propolis and honey in it. Best thing in the world to kill harmful bacteria in your mouth. And finally, plant extract may be effective against inflammatory bowel disease. From Science Daily, this is from the National Institutes of Health, the Department of Health and Nutritional Services, and it says, a South Dakota State University scientist research shows an extract made from the plant foods Brassica family was effective in alleviating signs of ulcerative colitis. The ongoing study said that the plant extract could also be used against colon cancer. Quote, "There's an established link between ulcerative colitis and colon cancer. People who have ulcerative colitis are significantly higher risk of having colon cancer." And then they're looking at this plant to see how it works. Well, and they've isolated the anti-inflammatory chemical in the plant. It's called PEITC, and it's very powerful anti-inflammatory. Well, good news for them, but guess what? You've already been using it all along, turning off inflammation. Why? Cauliflower, cabbage, broccoli. Yeah, that's all in there. And for those of you who've been using your green powders, you're using it already. Nice to be 15 years ahead of that curve. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, "Boy, oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, 'cause the woman that you love is gone. That's what she said. Only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall from all over the world. I'd like to welcome you, and I know that we're having people listen and you can watch. I'm in our studios in New York City. We're video streaming. You can go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and watch today's program, as well as listen to it. And if you miss a program, don't worry, you can download it. We have 700% more people download shows and listen live. So you have no problem getting this information. We're going to go to my guest, John Taylor Gatto, talking about the collapse of American education and America's weapons of mass education in a few moments. Just a few announcements. First and foremost, I'm going to be doing a lecture this Friday in New York City at 7 p.m. And this lecture is directly related to the recent, brand new film on love that many of you around the United States have seen. By the way, I want to thank all the people who were at the Health Support Group meeting last night in Florida, and especially the fact that you went out to the little homeless camps, the tents, and you brought in four of those vets. You're helping them out, giving them food and work. That was very thoughtful, very kind, very spiritual. And you see, even though there are up to 800,000 homeless vets in the United States each year, when you decide to make a difference for the person you're helping, that's a big difference. So I was happy to hear that. I was on the phone with him last night, and the meeting went very well. Anyhow, after my premiere, both in New York and Los Angeles and Atlanta and Denver and Florida, of the film Love, all in the last month, about the last 6 weeks, a lot of people, and I mean a lot, say, now that you've done this, we need help with relationships. Because how in the world can you share love if you first don't have a relationship? And the problem is the relationship. So I was thinking about it. So I had a long day of going up and back from my last trip on Saturday. And each day I would take time and I would write insights into why we don't have good relationships and how to make the right relationship. So my lecture is about creating the right relationship, the perfect relationship for you, whether you're single or married, with your children or loved ones or friends. They're all relationships. And if we don't get that right, even with the best of intentions, we end up self-sabotaging. So I'm going to be doing a lecture, probably about 2 hours. It'll be filmed this Friday. Now, I'm trying to get it where it can be streamed. I have to be aware from my IT person that we can stream it. If we can, then those of you who live outside the tri-state area can watch it. All over the world, you can watch it. But for those in the New York area, if you'd like to come and join me this Friday evening for my lecture on creating the perfect relationship and everything about relationships, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Also, you can do this. You can email Kara Lee here at the Progressive Radio Network with any questions you have. So the questions you have about relationship, I will incorporate. I already have 20 very important points, but I'm going to make it a longer lecture than normal so I can address the most important questions from people in this audience about relationships. The issues you find you're confused by or can't deal with or haven't got the answers you need, you can email us. Now, I'm going to have Kara Lee in here in a second, and then she'll give you the... You can go to info, I-N-F-O, at progressiveradionetwork.com. Info, I-N-F-O, info at progressiveradionetwork.com, and list the issues you would like to hear addressed. Okay? And if there's more of them than I can put into the lecture, I will then deal with them on the radio. So that's something I'm excited to share. I feel I'll be able to share a lot of new insights and important insights to help people who want to share love be able to have the right relationship in which to do that. And we've got a lot of lonely people in this world. That's one of the reasons they use the internet. That's one of the reasons you see people with the Twittering and Facebook. Not that I'm opposed to that per se, but I think it's not a substitution for quality relationship. When you relate to people, you should be relating to that person, eye to eye, heart to heart, mind to mind, not something that's abstract. And a whole generation is growing up in this society today that has lost the ability to have open, honest, progressive conversations, meaningful communications. Everything's a Twittered language, and that's unfortunate. Anyhow, we're going to have the antidote to that this Friday. That said, I now am going to introduce my guest by first introducing a discussion. Nice to have you with us today, John Taylor Gatto.
A pleasure to be with you, Gary.
John, I'm going to give you a long introduction by quoting from global researchers Henry Giroux, The Disappearing Intellectual in the Age of Economic Darwinism, because I believe it ties directly in to the topic that you're going to be discussing, all right?
All right.
So please be patient for about 5 minutes till I get through the most important parts of this discussion, because I feel they're extremely germane to everyone listening right now, okay? And then we'll segue into you. I'm quoting now from The Disappearing Intellectual by Henry Giroux in Global Research. We live at a time that might be appropriately called the age of the disappearing intellectual, a disappearance that marks with disgrace a particularly dangerous period in American history. While there are plenty of talking heads spewing lies and insults and nonsense in the various media, it would be wrong to suggest that these right-wing populists are intellectuals. They are neither knowledgeable nor self-reflective, but largely ideological hacks catering to the worst impulses in American society. Some obvious examples would include John Stossel, calling for the repeal of that section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that bans discrimination in public places. And of course, there are the more famous corporate-owned talking heads such as Glenn Beck, Charles Krauthammer, Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, all of whom trade in reactionary worldviews, ignorance, ideological travesties, and outlandish misrepresentations, all the while wrapping themselves in the populist creed of speaking for American everyday citizens. In a media scape and public sphere that few criticisms, dialogue, and thoughtfulness as liability, such anti-intellectuals abound, providing commentaries that are naive, racist, reactionary, and morally repugnant. But the premium put on ignorance and the disdain for critical intellectuals is not monopolized by the dominant media. It appears to have become one of the few criterion left for largely wealthy individuals to qualify for public office. One typical example is Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who throws out inanities such as labeling the Obama administration a gangster government. Bachmann refuses to take critical questions from the press because she claims they unfairly focus on her language. She has a point. After all, it might be difficult to support statements such as the claim that the U.S. government uses the census information to round up Japanese Americans and put them in concentration camps. Another typical example can be found in Congressman Joe Barton's apology to British Petroleum for having to pay for damages to the government stemming from its disastrous oil spill. The upscaling of ignorance gets worse. Richard Cohen, writing in the Washington Post about Senator Michael Bennet, was shocked to discover that he was actually well-educated and smart, but had to hide his qualifications in his primary campaign so as not to undermine his chance of being re-elected. Cohen concludes that in politics, quote, we have come to value ignorance. He further argues that the notion that a politician should actually know something about domestic and foreign affairs is now considered a liability. He writes, we now have politicians who lack a child's knowledge of government. To embrace the type of rabid individualism and anti-intellectualism and political illiteracy is also at work in the Tea Party movement. As social protections disappear, jobs are lost, uncertainty grows, and insecurity prevails, Tea Party members express anger over a weakened social state that represents one of the few institutions capable of providing the capital, policies, and safety nets necessary to protect those who have been shaken by the economic recession. As the belief in the libertarian agent, free of all dependencies and social responsibilities, blows up in the face of the current economic meltdown, anger replaces critique and ignorance informs politics. Bernstein thinks that members of the Tea Party are angry because they have been jolted into recognizing how fragile their so-called individual freedom actually is, and that it is the government that is somehow responsible for making them feel so vulnerable. Maybe so. But there is also something else at work here, less metaphysical and more realistic, a kind of intellectual vacuum produced at different levels of American society that cultivates ignorance, limits choices, legitimizes political illiteracy, and promotes violence. Another version of the anti-intellectualism prevails in universities, where students are urged by some conservative groups to spy on their professors to make sure they do not say anything that might actually get students to think critically about their beliefs. At the same time, faculty are being relegated to non-tenured positions, and because of the lack of tenure, which offers some guarantees, are afraid to say controversial things inside and outside the classroom for fear of being fired. Moreover, as the university becomes more corporatized, intellectual and critical thought is transformed into a commodity to be sold to the highest bidder. I'm not suggesting that so-called professed intellectuals are not influencing policy, appearing in the media or teaching in the universities, but these are not critical intellectuals. On the contrary, they are accommodating ideologues, content to bask in the politics of conformity and the rewards of official power. Underlying this drift towards the disappearing critical intellectual and the erasure of substantive critique is a regime of economic Darwinism, in which a culture of ignorance serves to both depoliticize the larger public while simultaneously producing individual and collective subjects necessary and willing to participate in their own oppression. The cheerful robot is not simply one of ignorance. It is a metaphor for this systemic construction in American society of a new mode of depoliticized and thoughtless form of agency. With the advent of neoliberalism, or what some call free market fundamentalism, we have witnessed the production and widespread adoption throughout society of what I would like to call the politics of economic Darwinism. As a theater of cruelty and a mode of public power, economic Darwinism undermines all forms of solidarity, while simultaneously promoting the logic of unrestricted individual responsibility. But there is more at stake here than unchecked ideology of privatization. For example, as the welfare state is dismantled, it is being replaced by the harsh realities of the punishing state of social problems are increasingly criminalized, and social protections are either eliminated or fatally weakened. The harsh values of this new social order can be seen in the increasing incarceration of young people, the modeling of public schools after prisons, and state policies that bail out investment bankers but leave the middle and working class in a state of poverty and despair and insecurity. But it can also be seen in the practice of socialism for the rich. This is a practice in which government supports for the poor, unemployed, sick, and elderly are derided because they are either contribute to an increase in the growing deficit or undermine the market-driven notion of individual responsibility. And yet, the same critics defend without irony government supports for the rich, the bankers, the permanent war economy, or any number of subsidies for corporations as essential to the life of the nation, which is simply an argument that benefits the rich and powerful and legitimizes the deregulation of the Wild West casino capitalism. Of course, this form of economic Darwinism is not enforced simply through the use of police and other repressive apparatuses. It is endlessly reproduced through the cultural apparatuses of the new and old media, public and higher education, as well as through the thousands of messages and narratives we are exposed to daily in multiple commercial spheres. In this discourse, the economic order is either sanctioned by God or exists simply as an extension of nature. In other words, the tyranny and suffering that is produced through the neoliberal theater of cruelty is unquestionable, as unmovable as an urban skyscraper. No long-term investments are now replaced by short-term gains and profits, while compassion is viewed as weakness and democratic public values are second to anything and scorned because they subordinate market considerations to the common good. Morality in this instance becomes painless, stripped of any obligations to the other. As the language of privatization, deregulation, commodification replaces the discourse of the public good, all things public, including public schools, libraries, and public services, are viewed either as a drain on the market or as a pathology. At the same time, inequality in wealth and income expands and spreads like a toxin through the everyday life, poisoning democracy and deregulating more and more individuals to a growing army of disposable human waste. The giant oil spill in the Gulf is rarely viewed as a part of a much broader systemic crisis of democracy. Instead, it is treated as an unfortunate disaster caused by corporate greed or negligence. Celebrity culture puts much of the population in a moral coma and perpetual state of ignorance, coupled with the power of economic Darwinism that is spewed out daily in the mainstream media. Large segments of the population are prevented from connecting the dots between their own personal troubles and the larger social problems. In this case, the larger structural elements of a corrupt economic system disappear while the suffering and hardship continues, and the bankers and other members of the financial criminal class run to the banks to deposit their obscene bonuses. Under such circumstances, to paraphrase C.W. Mills, we are seeing the breakdown of democracy, the disappearance of critical thought, and the collapse of those public spheres which offer a sense of critical agency and social imagination. Since the 1970s, we have witnessed the forces of market fundamentalism strip education of its public values, critical content, and civil responsibilities as part of its broader goal of creating new subjects wedded to the logic of privatization, efficiency, flexibility, consumerism, and the destruction of the social state. Tied largely to instrumental purposes and measured paradigms, many institutions of higher education are now committed almost exclusively to economic growth, instrumental rationality, and preparing students for the workplace. And in conclusion, the anti-democratic values that drive free market fundamentalism are embodied in policies now attempting to shape diverse levels of higher education all over the globe. The script has now become overly familiar and more taken for granted, especially in the United States and increasingly in Canada. Shaping the neoliberal framing of public and higher education is a corporate-based ideology that embraces standardization of curriculum, supporting top-down management, implementing more courses that promote business values, and reducing all levels of education to job training sites. For example, one university is offering a master's degree to students who simply commit to starting a high-tech company. The demise of democracy is now matched by the disappearance of vital public spheres and the exhaustion of intellectuals. Instead of critical and public intellectuals, faculty are increasingly defined less as intellectuals than as technicians, specialists, and grant writers. Nor is there any attempt to legitimize higher education as a fundamental sphere of creating the agents necessary for an inspiring democracy. In fact, the commitment to democracy is beleaguered, viewed less as a crucial educational investment than as a distraction that gets in the way of connecting knowledge and power to the production of material and human capital. In short, higher education is now being retooled as part of a larger political project to bring it in tune with the authority and values fostered the advance of neoliberalism. I think David Harvey is right in insisting the academia is being subjected to neoliberal disciplinary apparatuses of various kinds, while also becoming the place where neoliberal ideas are being spread. As a core political and civil institution, higher education rarely appears committed to addressing important social problems. Instead, many have become unapologetic accomplices to corporate values and power, and in doing so, increasingly make social problems either irrelevant or invisible. Steeped in the same market-driven values that produced the 2008 global economic recession, along with a vast amount of hardships and human suffering in many countries around the globe, higher education mimics the inequalities and hierarchies of power that inform the failed financial behemoths, banks, investment companies in particular, that have become public symbols of greed and corruption. Not only does neoliberalism undermine civic education and public values, it confuses education with training, but it also treats knowledge as a product, promoting a neoliberal logic that views schools as malls, students as consumers, faculty as entrepreneurs. Just as democracy appears to be fading in the United States, so is the legacy of higher education's faith in and commitment to democracy. As the humanities and liberal arts are downsized, privatized, and commodified, higher education finds itself caught in the paradox of claiming to invest in the future of young people while offering them few intellectual and civic and moral supports. Unquote. Now, to one statement that my guest made, and that's where we begin our discussion with him. Quote, from my guest, John Taylor Gatto, I taught for 30 years in some of the worst schools in Manhattan and some of the best, and during that time I became an expert in boredom. Boredom was everywhere in my world, and if you ask the kids, as I often did, why they felt so bored, they always gave the same answers. They said the work was stupid, that it made no sense, that they already knew it. They said they wanted to do something real, not just sitting around. They said teachers didn't seem to know much about their subjects and clearly weren't interested in learning more. And the kids were right. Their teachers were every bit as bored as they were. Boredom is the common condition of school teachers, and anyone who has spent time in a teacher's lounge can vouch for low energy. The whining, the dispirited attitudes to be found there. When asked why they feel bored, the teachers tend to blame the kids, as you might expect. Who wouldn't get bored teaching students who are rude and interested only in grades? Even if that were the case, of course, teachers are themselves products of the same 12-year compulsory school program that so thoroughly bored their students, and as school personnel, they are trapped inside structures even more rigid than those imposed upon the children. Who, then, is to blame? From a separate article, one paragraph. Let me speak to you about dumbness, because it is what schools teach best. Old-fashioned dumbness used to be the simple ignorance. You didn't know something, but there was always a way to find out if you wanted to. Government-controlled schooling didn't eliminate dumbness. In fact, we now know that people read more fluently before we had forced schooling, but dumbness was transformed. Now dumb people aren't just ignorant, they're the victims of the non-thought of second-hand ideas. Dumb people are now well informed about the opinions of Time magazine or CBS or New York Times and the president. Their job is to choose which pre-thought thoughts, which received opinions they like best. The elite in this new empire of ignorance are those who know the most pre-thought thoughts. Mass dumbness is vital to modern society. The dumb person is wonderfully flexible clay for psychological shaping by market research, government policymakers, public opinion leaders, and any other interested group. The more pre-thought thoughts a person has memorized, the easier it is to predict what choices they will make. What dumb people cannot do is think for themselves or even ever be alone for very long without feeling crazy. That is the whole point of national forced schooling. We aren't supposed to be able to think for ourselves because independent thinking gets in the way of professional thinking, which is believed to follow the rules of scientific precision. And those are comments from my guest. Now over to you. As I said, I had a long introduction to you. Your thoughts today. Now, John, please, and I will not interrupt you, so you can lay out your thesis on the entire idea of what has happened to a once vital, interesting, and dynamic educational system.
Well, Gary, there are a lot of avenues to get into this, but I think for someone who is used to thinking as an engineer, you know, clear thought, here are the materials I work with, here are the goals I want to reach, here are the steps. That's normal, it's highly intelligent, and it's absolutely the wrong way to think about how our schools became as they are, dissatisfying or horrifying to most of us. It took me 10 years, I would say, of around-the-clock research, because I was so fascinated with the idea, to track this thing down to its lair. And I believe and I hope that in short order I can say that schooling is a deliberate project. It's been worked at through history, but only in the 19th century were the methodologies to create a perfect managerial scheme. That is one in which all the rest of us are subordinated in various levels, and we, being divided and conquered, keep each other in place. And this allows the management fringe a free hand in decision making. And the steps along the way, I won't spend much time on each of them, but they're quite fascinating. If somebody has a free weekend or two, once you're put on the right road, it's fairly easy to see this thing being thought through, tested, and coming about. There, from Plato onward, right down to our own day, the managerial thinkers that end up as seminar courses at Harvard or Stanford are very few. I'll name some of them: Plato, John Calvin, Thomas Hobbes, Benedict Spinoza. He's usually written as Baruch Spinoza, but he never called himself Baruch in his life. Charles Darwin, Wilhelm Wundt, William James at Harvard at the beginning of the 20th century, who is the creator of academic psychology. It was a subdivision of philosophy, and not a very important one until James published Psychology in 1907 and made it a major intellectual subject. What are all these people, and many more that we don't need to name because you won't find any, what do they all agree on? They all agree that the human race is deeply flawed, Calvin on a religious basis, and Spinoza psychologically, and Darwin biologically, and only a very small fraction of the human race is evolving or headed toward perfection. The problems of the good people. Now, just remember that we've now covered in lightning fashion thousands of years. The problems of the good people, who are a tiny fraction, call them the managers, to be political about it. The problem of the managers is that the other people don't know how inferior they are. So a system has to be set up, or systems that allow them to believe they have a free hand, free will in creating their lives, that they're being educated rather than schooled. The schooled is what happens to fish. I'm not being, you know, wise, or no attempt to be witty there. A schooling can't be an education. They live in different planets. But all these people agreed that some way had to be found to keep 90 or more percent of the population in place. It was not until the beginning of the 19th century in the North German military state of Prussia that the breakthrough finally was made. The idea was to remove children from any significant influence, put them under the direction of hired strangers, flunkies, you might say, who simply do the orders of the managerial classes. And in this school time, they were to be habit trained and attitude trained. Intellectual training was overlooked or missed, not because these are meanies, Gary, but because they had philosophical reason to believe that it was impossible to educate the inferior. The biggest gun in the whole list of people who thought this way, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's considered a major figure who didn't think this way, but the big gun was Charles Darwin, a sweet man, a phenomenally wealthy man whose daily associations were with dukes and princes and major leaguers. That part's left out of school textbooks. Darwin, in writing Origin of Species, shook the entire planet up. But it was a book he wrote 12 years later called The Descent of Man that has given us the modern world that we're familiar with. In The Descent of Man, Darwin said, there is a tiny fraction of the human race evolving. Everybody else is an evolutionary dead end. And if the good breeding stock crossbreeds with the bad breeding stock, which remember outnumbers it 9 or 9.5 to 1, what will happen is evolution will march backwards into the, quote, swirling mists of the dawnless past. I mean, this shook up managerial circles. This was never shared with the upper middle classes, the middle classes, the ordinary, the poor. This was kept closely held. But anyone listening to you, Gary, anyone can go to their local public library, and the book will be in every library in the United States, probably every library in the world. Descent of Man, 1871. Read it very carefully. And you should become hot under the collar or laugh out loud if you happen to have any Irish ancestors, because the Irish are totally and completely evolutionarily inferior. And some way has to be kept. I'm using the Irish as the whipping boy here. He had a long list of other peoples. But the Irish were his particular bête noir. So they have to be kept away from the Scandinavian blondes, the English blondes, the German blondes, who are clearly evolution's darlings. Notice that Darwin's taught in every school in the United States, and I would bet my life not a single one of the texts carrying Darwin carries this major work, which had greater influence than Origin of Species, because a lot of people prior to Darwin had hit on the possibility that the various species of life were interconnected in some way.
But this was also, this gave fuel to the eugenicists. This gave fuel to the racists.
Oh, thank God you mentioned that, because I would have overlooked the fact that the word eugenics and all the eugenicists, not some of them, are the result of Darwin's first cousin, Francis Galton, who I was taught in high school, I was in high school in the 50s, was the single most intelligent human being who had ever lived.
John, hold your thoughts for 1 second. We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. Thank you very much for listening. You can continue listening over ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryNall.com. Please continue, because from eugenics we got Margaret Sanger, we got Pope and Pohl, we had a whole cast of top academics at Harvard, Yale.
Absolutely. The connection isn't peripheral.
Rockefeller, Carnegie, Woodrow Wilson, all of these people squashed independent thinking in our schools.
But Galton, this brilliant and fantastically wealthy man, as was Charles Darwin himself, and Galton, the associate of kings and princes and dukes, was the darling of the American academic community. He was brought here two or three times to personally anoint the eugenics groups that were forming in the United States. And I think almost at random, I mean, Galton's a fascinating figure, and he must have a library of 40 volumes to his credit. I've read perhaps 15 of them. I'd be willing to bet that blindfolded, you could pick any one of the books, and quickly, whatever it seemed to be about, it would quickly become about the duty of the best breeding stock to push the inferior to the fringe and to make breeding the central role of the college fraternity. That happened at the University of Indiana at the turn of the 20th century. I know this sounds like it'll be a fussy academic detail, but bear with me for another 60 seconds, because it's not. The president of the University of Indiana personally taught a course in how to take control of evolution, how to push the inferior, recall that's 19 people out of 20, to the fringes to keep them from breeding with the good stuff. That man became the first president of the Harvard of the American West, Stanford University, in about 1905, and he took with him his star pupil, Elwood Cubberly, a silly name but not a silly man, to become the first dean of teacher education at Stanford University. What Cubberly's qualification was, is he was the star pupil in eugenics. Now, they had covered the name eugenics, because it was already causing an awful lot of consternation, as you might expect, worldwide, and they called it bionomics. And so bionomics became the center of the curriculum all over the elite colleges in the United States. Now get ready to get what I hope is a big surprise to you. About 10 years ago, I was invited by the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., a group of people I have a rather high regard for, to be a keynote speaker at the 6th annual Bionomics Conference. It was out at the Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco, and I took my cat with me and smuggled her into the room there. Here was a group of glittering intellectuals and wealthy people from all over the world at the Mark Hopkins, 500 bucks a day, and they were picking up the cudgels and carrying them. I was, to say the least, astounded when at the farewell dinner that the creator of bionomics, his name slips me, but he had a best-selling book about 15 or 20 years ago, gave a talk at the farewell dinner in which he said, "Do not be alarmed at reports of mass deaths around the earth and of various kinds of oppression of people that seem abnormally cruel." He said, "This is all part of the design," he said, "because when people are under stress, the ordinary biology fails to reproduce. So it's necessary for us to apply this stress in order to control the growth and eventually to diminish the percentage of ordinary biology." To say the hair stood up on my head as I was eating some, blue ribbon luncheon there, and here were the assembled glitterati of the planet nodding their heads that we needed to do this and we wouldn't be alarmed.
That doesn't.
So this is a project. I really got carried away, and I apologize, but it's necessary to understand where the mechanisms of schooling come from because they will continue no matter how much you reform this school or that school, or you do a systemic reform. Schools are producing exactly the product they were assigned to produce. And for those of your listeners who are passionately into research, I would urge you to pick up a book written by a Harvard professor who is the professor their honor lecture in education is named after. Alexander Ingalls is his name, spelled I-N-G-L-I-S, written in 1917, in which he lays out clearly what the real purposes of the new institutional school are. There are six of them, and they should curdle your blood and make your hair stand on end. This man was the editor of the largest textbook publishing house of his day. He was the editor of the elementary school division, as well as a Harvard professor, and the editor of the secondary school division. Mifflin was the publisher, was none other than Elwood Coverley of Stanford. This network of minds who agreed on a purpose can be traced fairly easily. You do not need conspiracy literature. They're very, very open about what they're about. They simply don't speak through public journals, but their talks and their writings are readily available once you understand what the game is.
John, what I would like to do is the following. I would like to continue this discussion and bring it forward. I have a lot of issues I would like to address, and we're going to need some time. Would you be available for my 3 o'clock live show, which broadcasts out of the Progressive Radio Network, and specifically...
Oh, absolutely. I'd make myself available.
Okay, make yourself available. I will have you at the top of the show.
I don't want to flatter you, but you've been such an inspiration to our family for 30 years. Set the nutritional stuff, which is vital, aside. You're probably the only honest voice about the various, quote, wars that we've passed through in my lifetime. So absolutely, I'd be available.
John, I look forward to continuing this. We'll continue this discussion at 3 o'clock, and we will get into the whole idea of education today is just preparing people to take tests, that we have both illiterate teachers, illiterate administrators, and illiterate children, and what this will mean for them, and the economic political essay, which was recent, in fact, this past week, by the author about high IQ idiots who have a kind of rock star status in the media and in Washington, but who are quite clueless about human nature. So we're going to talk about all this later today.
Excellent. And now that the historical background is laid down, I have a great many specifics, including, I'll just get to tease you, including a lecture I was giving at a Westchester high school recently that was closed by the police, and all I was doing was reading the standardized test scores of famous Americans. That's all I was doing, and not in a very inflammatory way. The police broke into the auditorium with loudspeakers, dismissed the classes, and told me to leave immediately or I would be arrested. I was amused because I've lived so long and I understood what was going on, but to see it nakedly poking through the surface that way in it was Rockland County, not Westchester. just tickled my sense of irony. All right, I'll be available, Gary, at 3 o'clock. And
thank
I'll
you very much,
by.
John. John Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, my guest. We will continue this conversation. He is the author of Weapons of Mass Education, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Education. His website is johntaylorgatto.com, and he was named New York City Teacher of the Year 3 times and awarded the New York State Teacher of the Year also. And he's received the Advancement Education Freedom Award as well. I'm Gary Noll. See you in 2 hours.
The Gary Noll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. Thank you.